The Pat Kenny Show on News Talk.
Few figures in Irish sport have cast as long a shadow as Roy Keane. Now, to some, he's the embodiment of elite standards and uncompromising honesty. To others, he represents something else, a kind of cultural hard edge that seeped far beyond football. A new book argues that Keane's influence didn't just shape teams, but helped to shape modern Ireland itself. We need to talk about Roy. The Keenification of Modern Ireland is written by Dave Hannigan, contributor with the Irish Times and based in New York. And he joins me now on the line. Dave, good morning and welcome.
Good morning, Pat.
Now, let's talk about your title, first of all, and that word, the Keenification of Modern Ireland. What do you mean by that?
I guess what I was trying to capture with that word and that kind of quirky title was how he has been the national obsession, the national argument, if you like, for nearly four decades now. You know, we've been obsessed with Keane in one way or another since 1990, since his days as a kind of a teenage footballer at Nottingham Forest, right up to his, you know, the current phase of his life, the grey-bearded influencer phase that he inhabits right now.
Now, the intersections that you had with Roy Keane, I mean, you're in a very good place to write about him because your lives did cross many, many times.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up, I'm 9 months older than Roy Keane, but I grew up playing soccer against him. So I grew up in the 70s and 80s in Cork, the same Cork that he grew up in, and I met him on the playing fields. He played for a very famous, all-conquering, successful team called Rockmount. I played for a less successful teams, but I did run into him a lot and was, you know, defeated by him a lot. I did train with him a couple of times at a kind of a 7-up soccer school that was run one Easter by Billy Bingham, the then Northern Ireland manager. So I had a lot of intersections with him. I saw him and his team, you know, they were, everybody in the whole city looked up to that team and, you know, they were the benchmark for all the rest of us. But he was not the only great player on that team. It was a team of like all stars, if you want, and any one of them looked like they could make it. He just happened to make it in a bigger way than any of them.
Now, he was small. And later on, he disgracefully grew a mullet. But this is pre-mullet days. He was a small teenager, and that kind of made for difficult to predict that he was going to ever make it as a footballer because he was so small.
Absolutely. You know, there were a lot of English scouts, or, you know, the Irish scouts, in the people in Ireland, the scouts in Ireland who worked for the English clubs, a lot of them looked at that Rockmount team and they sent over some of those players to England on trials and some of them got contracts over there. But Roy Keane, the knock on him always was that he was too physically too small and too light and he wouldn't be able to cut it, which was obviously a ludicrous argument because there's way more to football than size and physique. But that was the kind of the lazy response of scouts when Keane's name came up.
Yeah, and if you think of the Messis of today and the Modrics, you know, you don't have to be a towering Ronaldo to be a hugely influential player.
No, but I also think this helped Keane because it gave him a chip on his shoulder. You know, not that any Cork person ever needs a bigger chip on their shoulder, but it gave him a chip on his shoulder in terms of he always felt that he had something to prove, and that kind of informed the way he played the game, even from his mid-teens onwards.
Now, there's something extraordinary. He went on a FOSS course to teach football.
Yeah, in the story of Roy Keane, like in the fairy tale rise of him when he gets to Forest in 1990, the makings of him before 1990 is he goes on this FOSS course, which every League of Ireland club was allowed to sign two young players and send them to Palmerston in Dublin for 5 days a week, residential. They trained every day. They basically mimicked the lifestyle of a professional footballer. And those people who were on that course with Roy Keane talk about what an incredible attitude he had, how hard he worked every day and how much he was pushing himself. And then when he does go to Forest, at the end of that 1 year FOSS course, when he does go to Forest, like he hits the ground running, he is physically probably better prepared for the challenges of the English game when he arrived than any kid who ever left Ireland before, because he had this hothouse training for almost a year that had really kind of built him up and made him stronger.
And of course he was away from home for those 5 days, and that gave him a taste of what it might be like when he eventually signs for Forest. And Brian Clough understands this is a man who loves his home place, and he facilitates him getting home as often as he could.
Yeah, Brian Clough is, you know, there would be no Roy Keane. We would not be talking about this today if there wasn't a Brian Clough who took a chance on this newly arrived teenager from Cork and then had the man management skills to see that this kid was away from home. He could fly back to Cork quite easily, and he encouraged him to go back to Cork for a couple of days every week just to kind of, you know, acclimatise slowly. Now, another side to that was obviously he was going back to Cork and he probably wasn't training when he was there. He was enjoying himself a little too much at times, but it was a very, very smart play by Clough to ensure that he stayed happy and content and then performed better on the field.
Now, you're another eyewitness to a little bit of Keno history, and that is him being turned away by a bouncer in a Cork nightclub when he was already big time.
Yeah, he played at Lansdowne Road on a Saturday afternoon and scored. And then that night, I was at the game in Lansdowne Road. And that night, I was out in Cork. I'd come home for the weekend, and I was out in Cork that night. And I was outside Cuban's nightclub waiting to get in when Roy Keane was up ahead of us online or in the queue. And he got turned away by a bouncer. And I thought, like, geez, this guy is, you know, a superstar for his country, played for his country today. And here he is trying to get into a grotty nightclub in Cork and extend his days, his nights socialising with his friends, and he's turned away. And what struck me was, you know, if he was in England, if he was in London outside a nightclub and he was an English international, he'd have been ushered in and gotten the velvet rope treatment and, you know, looked after by the management. Whereas here, the instinct of the bouncer was, I'm going to cut him down to size. You know, I'm going to show him he's not that big a deal in this town yet.
Mm. Now, the extraordinary thing, the Roy Keane we know today is a man, you know, in middle age and responsible family man and so on. But the young Roy, which you capture very well, the Roy who comes back with the sports car, the red sports car with the Roy 1 number plate, wearing very conspicuous designer gear. This is a Roy we don't feel we know or knew.
Yeah, it seems like ancient history, you know, but that was like the early 90s, before the Celtic Tiger, before the affluence. And he came back and he wasn't the first immigrant to go somewhere, make some money and come back and kind of want to show it off and wear it and drive it. But he definitely did a bit of that. And it was before, you know, it was when people didn't have designer clothes in Ireland in the 1990s and they didn't have personalized number plates and were driving sports, Mercedes sports editions, you know.
Now, I'll leap forward to when he left Manchester United, as we know, after that spat with Alex Ferguson when he was too frank with MUTV, and that was the end of him. But he sits down with the family and says, you know, now that I'm no longer a key player of Manchester United, things are going to be a little bit different around here. You know, in other words, I'm not going to be earning the big bucks. Things are going to change. Well, they didn't have to change, really, but it shows an interesting mindset.
It does. And like, my thesis is, like, we're all products of the environment where we grew up. And he grew up in a very depressed city, in a very depressed part of a very depressed city, economically disadvantaged. The family didn't have a car. You know, I make the point in the book, in 1971, the year he was born, there was an ad in a newspaper in Cork looking for 11-year-old girls to work in a shoe factory, full-time job, great prospects. And I'm like, that's the world he came out of, you know, and he grew up with very little. So even though he was the highest paid player in Britain in the late 1990s, earning, you know, 52 grand a week at one point at United, he was still conscious now that, you know, maybe the budget had to change, even though they're in this mansion in Cheshire, you know.
No, he had obviously his difficulties, that famous cruciate ligament injury, which he probably came back in record time because such was his diligence in staying fit and on the ball. What was it, do you think, about Roy himself that enabled him to, in his earlier footballing days, play so hard, but also to work so hard at perfecting what happened on the field?
I think that drive, again, is a product of his childhood. Like, he was driving himself from a young age. He thought he missed the boat. He, you know, at 17 and even at 18, it looked like Roy Keane was going to be, if he was lucky, get a job, you know, get a menial job in Ireland, play a bit of League of Ireland for some side income. And that was his life. And then suddenly he gets to England and the opportunity opens up for him. And he always played like he was never going to relinquish the opportunity, that he always played like that his contract was on the line. You know, every game that Roy Keane played, it wasn't like he'd been there 10 years and he was a multimillionaire. He was still playing with that hunger and that drive, and that was the standards that he set himself right up to the end of his time at United.
Now, there are so many contradictions about Roy Keane, and I'm not sure whether you see some of those contradictions as just a natural evolution. And one of the ones I point to is when he queues up to have a picture taken with George Best, of course, who was the idol of all time, I suppose, in Manchester United. Almost, they used to call him a Beatle because of his hairstyle and his lifestyle. And he queued up for hours to get a picture with George Best, who was over, I think, to open a Ladbrokes bookies shop. And it's the kind of thing that Roy, in later years, would not have done so willingly for a child queuing up for a pic with him.
No, there's a lot of contradictions, as you point out. He, you know, that day summed up his lifestyle in his mid-teens. He was unemployed. He was unemployed, and George Best coming to open a bookie shop was a glamorous event. He stood outside the bookies with his dog, actually holding up his dog as well, and he goes in and gets the photograph taken. And now you see many viral videos of Roy Keane going to great lengths to avoid having his photograph taken. It's actually part of his kind of grumpy middle-aged man persona. Is I refuse to let my have a picture taken with somebody. But, you know, a lot has changed. Many of us, we change between our 20s and our 50s. We hopefully evolve. Our positions on various things change. If you'd have said to Roy Keane at 27 that at 54 he would be a TV pundit star bigger than even he was on the field, and, you know, a media darling and a one-man media industry, if you like.
Yeah. He would have been shocked
and appalled.
That he actually took the Sun newspaper's shilling to write a column, which would be done by dictating down the phone to a reporter who'd actually write the copy. And he gave it up after a few weeks because he couldn't form opinions on things. And now, of course, that's how he earns his crust, forming very provocative opinions on just about everything.
Yeah, and the funny thing with that is, you know, that he will speak about anything, like leaf blowers, barbecue, parties, fireworks. He offers his singing at concerts, you know. There's a whole range of things that Roy Keane offers opinions on. And the amazing thing about that is people who listen to him and who watch these clips don't even, a lot of the younger people don't even remember the footballer. Like, they weren't even born when this guy was in his pomp with United in the 90s.
Now, you've got Forest, you've got United, you've got Celtic, then you've got management. So many chapters to Roy's career. Are there deficits that you identify, you know, things that he would wanted to have achieved perhaps and hasn't?
I think the management thing, he had some success with Sunderland. That was an extraordinary journey in the first year and a half with Sunderland, even the first 2 years at Sunderland, keeping them in the Premier League, getting into the Premier League and keeping them there. But there's no doubt that his management career is not the management career that he would have wanted.
Now, he's a man who's devoted to the things he believes in, including the Irish Guide Dogs for the Blind, and he works at every possible opportunity for them. And that's a really positive side of his character. But I suppose we can't talk about the Keenification of modern Ireland, which is the subtitle of your book, without using the S word, Saipan.
Yes, the dreaded Saipan. You know, in my day job, Pat, I teach history to American college students, and Saipan here means something completely different. It means one of the bloodiest wars, one of the bloodiest battles, sorry, in World War II. So it's very funny when I wear my different hats and I talk to Irish people, Saipan means Mick McCarthy versus Roy Keane, and the quarter of a century on, it still opens all wounds and people are still bitter and angry about it. But I thought, you know, going back to it, it was fascinating to me in terms of it exposed, you know, this very Irish tendency. We have to split to call, you know, what time are we having the split? The old Brendan Behan gag. And it also brought to the fore, like, that himself and McCarthy didn't get on and had never got on. And it was a failure of management by McCarthy and by the FAI, and maybe by Keane too, not to address the lingering resentment between the two of them. I make the point in the book that, like, you know, in a lot of Irish families, there are falling outs and feuds that are allowed to fester for years and years. And then maybe come to a point at a wedding or a funeral. And that's what happened here. We just kind of buried our heads in the sand, let this thing go. And as it happened, it just happened to explode at the worst possible moment as we are on the brink of a World Cup.
At a World Cup that we had a chance of advancing further than we did because of the state of world football at the time.
Absolutely. It was a very mediocre World Cup and we really had a chance. You know, America got to the quarterfinals that year. We absolutely had a chance of going deeper into that World Cup, I think, even than Italian 90. The semifinals were a certain possibility for us. And that was the sadness of it. You know, when you look back in it, you think it was a chance missed and we haven't been back to one since. And who knows when we're going to get to one again.
Do we know whether they buried the hatchet, Mick and Roy, because they did have to deal with each other in management issues?
They did. They did bury the hatchet and they had a meeting before they first clashed as managers in the 5 or 6, it was about 5 or 6 years afterwards that they were on opposing sides and they had a meeting before that game and so to iron things out so then they could shake hands for the cameras as the managers do before and after all of these games. But I think maybe the movie has opened all wounds because I saw McCarthy was dining out on some criticisms of Keane lately at a public event. So who knows? Who knows where they stand today?
Yeah, but I'm just wondering, when you, for example, see Patrick Vieira and Roy chatting amiably to each other when in the tunnel they would be almost daggers drawn, you know, your life becomes the stuff of anecdote, really, in the end.
Yeah, and look, and Keane has turned everything in his career into a kind of into an anecdote, and even to a commercial possibility. Like some of the incidents he's had with the press over the years are now the stuff of Sky Mobile commercials, where he is the butt of the joke, and he is the joke kind of thing.
Well, he certainly has matured. It's a brilliant book. I really, really enjoyed reading it. It's called We Need to Talk About Roy, The Keenification of Modern Ireland is its subtitle. And its author, Dave Hannigan. Dave, thank you very much for joining us from New York.
Thank you very much, Pat.
At Kenny Show, Saturday and Sunday from 10 a.m. on News Talk. Conversation that counts.